Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. We are now in the new year, believe it or not. I mean,
oh,
we
God,
aren't,
this is scary.
But yeah. You are.
Yeah. We're recording this before Christmas.
So for those of you who have survived the inevitable apocalypse that occurred as it went to 1161 on December the 31st, 2020, we do apologise, but now you have some good listening material. Mm-hmm. The Drakenophil line of lead umbrellas and asbestos suits is available for order now.
Oh, good. And the Dr. Alex Clark very special hello book is also available for order right now. That will tell you how to give people the custom welcoming hello that will guarantee you free passage through the nuclear wasteland.
The heads on spikes ratio for buildings has increased from more than 1 to 1, which is always a good thing. Yep. But with that wonderful and cheery introduction, let us introduce you to Bilge Pumps episode 31.
Now, you might have noticed there is a voice missing. Now, the reason Jamie is missing is because, quite simply, the amount of swearing and pure Australianness which came out the moment we mentioned New Year's resolutions for navies, and exactly something to do, I think it was, something was heavily being mentioned about the actual procurement of submarines by the Australian Navy, but it was just such a pure track. Help me out here. What was it like listening to?
If you could distill rage into a usable power source, we would have solved the global power issues. Green revolution would be now. As it was, since we failed to do that, this, given that it is now 2021, we do apologize for the Australia falling off of the earth. We may have slightly detached it from its foundations by unleashing the pure, unadulterated Australian rage. To those of you aboard the ISS, look out. Say hi to the kangaroos on the way past.
I don't know. So, the theme of today's episode is New Year resolutions for navies. Now, the other good idea, which Jamie had before he got onto the submarine track, which turned into what it did, was that the Royal Navy needs to start turning the taps off.
Mm.
Or at least needs to get its seals fixed. The aircraft carrier is being immobilized because someone hasn't put proper bolts on the pipework. Is pretty silly. So I'd like to fix that.
Mm.
But what else?
Oh, there's a whole long list of things. I mean, New Year's resolution, I think I'm going to start with some of the smaller navies. New Year's resolution for the Italian Navy. Continue being surprisingly excellent.
That works for the Danish Navy as well.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure how they've managed to accomplish this. It may be because they exhausted all the options of doing things horribly wrong during the Second World War. And now they're left with only good decisions. But yes, I would dearly like to see the Italian Navy continue its tradition of quietly getting on with building some remarkably capable and well-equipped vessels.
Mm. If slightly short-legged.
Yeah, shockingly, they don't really care that much about what happens outside the Mediterranean. I suspect it's a little bit of cultural inertia from the Roman Empire.
Mm.
Yes, who else can we think of?
We should probably have Simon on to discuss that at some point this year.
Mm.
As we are in 2021, we are also thinking about, and again, this is an update, while I remember, the bilge pumps of simsec@gmail.com. If you are going to send us suggestions to join us for January, please do send your suggestions into there. There will be a link below in the description.
Then I think we've got New Year's resolution for the Japanese Navy.
Actually build an aircraft carrier?
Yeah, I was going to say, just drop the pretense. Yeah. If it requires a modification to your constitution, let's face it, I don't think anyone's going to object too much these days.
They're going to look China next door to you and go, you finally decided to do it.
Mm, yeah, and I mean, when you named one of your honestly not carriers Gov Karga, I think the game was up at that point. So you might as well bring out Taiho and Akagi and Soryu, Hiryu.
If you don't want to look like you're that bad, you can just buy a working design off Britain that will carry the aircraft you want to carry it.
Yeah, it's yeah, that would be my New Year's resolution for the Japanese Navy. Just drop the pretense and go back to being the Imperial Japanese Navy, complete with golden chrysanthemum, because that's always quite a fetching bow ornament.
Yeah, that might upset quite a few of the neighbours, though, let's be honest.
True, but...
I remember when we talked about that with Jamie, that was also... That didn't quite give quite the same fiery, slightly scary, almost demonic glow, but it did definitely cause a reaction.
Yeah, but to be honest, at this point, well... I think we're all big enough to get over a golden flower stuck on the front of a ship.
Yeah.
There are much bigger things to worry about.
Mm.
U.S. Navy. My New Year's resolution for the U.S. Navy would be keep up the good work with your renaming or your new naming conventions, I should say. And please, as you're beginning to show some indications of, show a bit more rationality in your procurement procedures. It would life so much easier for everybody.
Although I am so tempted to say that basically the trouble is they've got the FFGX that fit the criteria they came up with, but now they're looking at everyone else going buying the Type 26. And when I say everyone else, I mean Canada, Britain, Australia, and they're thinking, hang on, which navies do we tend to end up going to war with alongside Canada, Britain, Australia? And I'm wondering if the whole hesitance is because they're thinking, as I think we were talking about as well at the time, the idea of a Five Eyes frigate. Because I think even if the US Navy bought them as well, then you have to wonder, would the New Zealand Navy not end up going, well, we need to buy a couple of frigates, we might as well buy the same one that everyone else is buying. Or variations of it.
Yeah. It's certainly something that... I think that would be a more general naval New Year's resolution of commonality of design would be a nice thing.
If you can't get it with everyone, just try and go for the people you actually end up going to war with.
Mm-hmm. On the same side, hopefully.
Well, it's best, but you never know.
We've covered the Royal Navy, but I think the other New Year's resolution for the Royal Navy would probably be please, please, please tell us what the Type 32 is actually going to be.
Oh, yeah, but also can I add, please, 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 let's actually be honest about what the literal strike ship's going to be at this point. The amount of discussions I've seen which have slowly evolved it from a converted container ship into something which is sounding increasingly like an LHD, but it's honestly not an LHD, Gov, are starting to sound very interesting. It's like the idea that came up, it should be able to refuel the F-35. Well, how's the F-35 going to land on your converted container ship if it has to do a rolling landing?
Call it Ocean 2 and have done with it.
Yeah.
Make things a lot easier.
Or the Fearless class.
Yeah.
Build three of them. Replace Albion and Bulwark when their time comes with these ones and call them Fearless, Intrepid, and what should we call the third one? Ark Royal?
I prefer to keep Ark Royal for a full-size carrier.
Eagle?
Yeah, Eagle will do.
Mm.
Yeah, Fearless, Intrepid, and Eagle actually sounds quite good.
Mm.
Then what? Who else have we got out there? For the Turkish and Greek navies, if you are going to come to blows this year, please do it at Salamis, because there's a whole load of thematic resonance there.
Yeah, that would allow us to talk about so much history. Mm-hmm. You know, do bilge pumps a solid.
The Spanish Navy, if you're going to insist on continuing to build bricks, at least paint them red.
And can we not? I keep hearing various ideas coming through about the idea that you're going to start readopting the naming conventions, which led to what fought at the Armada. Please don't.
Mm.
We do not need names which are about 12 words long coming up back into the naming scenario.
I'd force them to build bigger ships just to fit the name on the wraparound.
I would accept that to an extent. As long as I only had to call the ship by, I don't know, the first word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's very appropriate given the number of names I've had to chew through for looking at the Battle of Trafalgar.
Mm-hmm.
Germany. Oh, Germany. Builder of U-boats still. Pretty good at that. But, yeah.
What happened to your ship deconstruction, though, Germany?
But they do have a history of slightly dropping the ball on this. But yes, please find whoever designed your latest theoretical concept for your destroyer dash frigate hybrid and tell them that one, masts are a thing, two, firing your CRAM exhaust into your VLS system is probably not the wisest of ideas, and three, if you're going to build a stealth ship, you don't immediately then compromise the stealth by putting little wings everywhere.
I'd also add, could you stop them being so obsessed with Red Dwarf? They do not need to make everything look like Crichton.
Mm.
Loves having an homage to him, but he doesn't need that. He doesn't need it for those egos.
Yeah, bear in mind, faceted stealth was a thing on the F-117, and that's a little bit old now.
Mm-hmm.
We're all about the smooth surfaces these days. The Russian Navy, I'm actually quite looking forward to seeing if they'll actually get Kuznetsov back into something like working order.
Is it cruel that for them, I hope they do. For the Kuznetsov, I hope they don't, because I think that poor ship has suffered enough.
Well, I'd make it a New Year's resolution for the Russians just so that they can still say they have an operational carrier, which would be nice. Because, on the one hand, I mean, it works both ways, to be honest. On the one hand, it means they can say they have an operational carrier, which means that they're probably put the replacement, which might actually work, on the back burner. And secondly, it also means that the Queen Elizabeth can have a partner to kind of comfort every time it sails down the North Sea and the Channel.
Oh, God, again. Okay, and if anyone does feel like building a third Queen Elizabeth for the Royal Navy, just make sure it's 36 metres longer. Okay? Mm-hmm. This is going to be my personal bugbear now for the next 40 years. But it... I love these... I have to say, if I was going to go for Russian Navy's New Year's resolutions, I would say... You've got to sort out your heavy engineering plant supply. You've got to get your engines. You've either got to start buying Chinese engines, because they're obviously building something for their aircraft carriers, or you have got to work it out yourself. And considering you're a nation which produced the quality of rocket engines you did, why have you found producing decent ship engines so frigging difficult?
Rocket-powered ship? I mean, how fast would a missile boat go if you strapped an Energia to it? Or actually, I suppose, given a missile boat, you'd probably be strapping the boat to the Energia, but never mind.
Very fast, but I'm not sure how, I'm not sure exactly how far you want that boat to go.
Oh, on a ballistic arc, it'll go a fair distance.
Yes.
I mean, that could bring back the age of the ram. Just a small power plant to get you into an approximate position, and then just a socking great rocket engine with a big pointy metal spike at the front. I mean, I can't see much that's going to take down an Energia in time.
We could have just reinvented the working version of the hypersonic missile.
Mm. Mind you, are they going to have their latest Kirov refit out this year, do we think?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be an interesting New Year's resolution if they can get that up and working. I would be interested to see what they can do with it. I mean, this is the thing. For all the fact that we do sometimes like to affectionately rib on the Russians, they have for the last few decades been following a somewhat slightly different tech tree, if you like, to a lot of other navies. So it is always interesting to see what they come out with, because apart from anything else, it's just so much different. In South Korean Navy, please retain your title as world's most missileist ship.
Yes.
And if what anyone tries to displace you, please build a bigger one, because...
Oh, you know they're going to.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
I'd say New Year's resolution next year, this is not for Navy, any Navy specifically, but this is for the naval debates that goes on.
Hmm.
Can we please stop having people go, it has to be Corbett or Mahan? You need both.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great friend called BJ Armstrong, who teaches at the US Naval Academy. And he did his PhD with Andrew Lambert at the same time as me, and it was on Alfred Thayer Mahan. And he actually produced a book saying, what would Mahan do? And the whole time, every time I hear a debate going on and they're talking about the theory of future naval warfare, all these things, they're always going, are you going for a Corbett strategy or a Mahan strategy? You need both. And a guy called Cable. And I wouldn't pass up taking a look at a guy called Richmond, even though I disagree with quite a lot of what he wrote. And there are a few others as well, which it's worthwhile reading them all to get a well-rounded view of what you might need to do. And actually, the Navy, which probably needs to read them all, and actually that should probably be a New Year's resolution for, is, and I say this with the whole love and grace, the Indian Navy.
Hmm.
Because I love them, but they are. If you look at what they're talking about, what they traditionally have been is for something to attack the flank of Pakistan. Then they've become about controlling the Indian Ocean. And now they are evolving into a large power tool to try and offset some of the Chinese infrastructure advantages in the high north of India, to sort of deal the issues they've got going on there.
Mm-hmm.
That Navy is well read. They are well studied. But one of the things I have noticed, and Drac, you can say if you agree with this or not, they have a lot of teeth, but I'm not seeing a lot of auxiliaries coming through at the moment.
Is the major shortfall of an awful lot of navies is that the lack of the logistics tail. You can point to any number of navies in the world that theoretically have an on paper strength of close to or almost equivalent to the bigger navies like the Marine Nationale and the Royal Navy. And maybe even some that are bigger still. But an awful lot of it is, we can defend our own front door. That's really about it. Because mm-hmm. we're going to be relying on some friendly ports to go anywhere else. And to be fair...
Or American logistics to go anywhere else.
Yeah. And to be fair, if a lot of those countries end up in a war, they probably will either have friends or they're going to be fighting on their own doorstep at the moment, so that makes a certain amount of sense. But one, there is still a certain amount of tactical flexibility involved, because just because you have friends now doesn't mean you're always going to have friends in the future, and they might want their ships for something else. Because with the best will in the world, if you're, say, relying on American logistics, that's fine right up until the point that America gets stuck into some fairly major conflict that demands its full attention, at which point you can guarantee that, for fairly understandable reasons, US Military Sealift Command will be prioritizing ships flying the American flag first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always best to have your own. And also, you don't know where you're going to end up 10, 15, 20 years down the line. I mean, in the pre-Christmas episode, I know we were mentioning the Brazilian Navy.
Yes.
And the Brazilian Navy is actually a very good case study in that.
The episode we actually tried to record, we actually recorded this morning, technically.
Yes. But the Brazilian Navy has a lot of ships and has historically operated carriers or carrier-like vessels for quite a while. They are the largest navy on the South American continent. Whether they are the highest quality navy, I don't necessarily know. I know the Chilean navy is very good, but I wouldn't want to make a call on that particular one because I don't know the exact differences between the two. But regardless,
and let's be honest, the Chilean navy will use the fact that to get to them, the Brazilian navy has to go round a very, very nasty piece of ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be honest, I haven't heard bad things about the Peruvian Navy either.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
They're one of the little quiet ones you don't hear much about.
I have to say, I don't hear much good about the Venezuelan Navy.
No, well, they did try and take on a cruise ship. That didn't end well.
Yeah, that didn't end well. Type of cruise ship you do not take on and try and get in the way at sea. Icebreaker grade hull.
But if you're looking at the Brazilian Navy, they're in a bit of a weird position, at least as far as I'm concerned, because they have this large navy. They have operated what are traditionally seen as the capital ships of global powers. But what are they actually wanting to do with that navy? Because
they seem to spend a lot of time going up and down their coast visiting their own ports.
Yeah, but they've got more than enough firepower to lay waste to any other navy on the east side of South America.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't actually need the navy at the size that it is to do that. They could make it smaller, but if the size that they're at, that makes more sense if they're looking at being able to project power elsewhere in the world, which, again, to a certain degree, does make sense. That is one of the traditional roles of naval power. But they don't have the logistical train to do so. And to be honest, a lot of their ships are quite small. So, yeah, I think for the Brazilian Navy, going back to what we were talking about earlier, my New Year's resolution would be get some logistics ships in and standardize on a class of slightly larger frigates or maybe small destroyers and then start showing up all over the place.
I think that is one of the issues which, though, I am starting to sort of get the idea of, is that the Brazilian Navy is very good, but if they want to start to achieve the level they seem to be hitting for, they need auxiliaries. And I think in the previous discussion, you mentioned using a Type 32 frigate or something, a Type 31 frigate size, and that's the size vessel. And they need to actually go for some new build frigates and escorts.
Yeah.
Now, there is always the Miko range, but again, the trouble is the Germans keep designing those. Oh, hang on. Damon did some new good designs next year. So what do you think about that? What would be New Year's resolution for the Dutch? Should they start buying Damon again?
Oh, that's... That's actually a good one. The Dutch... It'd be nice to see the Dutch Navy back in action. The thing is, with the Dutch Navy, I'm not sure in what exact direction you'd want to take them. Because They are. I think that they're sitting in that realm that, ironically enough, they're also sitting in at the beginning of World War II, of relatively small but fairly capable. And if they're sitting in that little niche, it depends where it, I say, it depends where their strategic vision is going to lie. Is it going to lie in being part of a European-NATO, almost self-interested response to keeping their waters secure, and that's it? In which case, the only people they're really looking at is either Russia or possibly people acting up in the Mediterranean, whether that be Turkey or whoever else. In which case, they're probably good as they are. Or if the EU is going to take a more proactive role as a combined force, whether that be with an EU defense fleet or whether that just be kind of operating everybody's individual ships under roughly the same banner. If that is going to happen, that means at some point the EU is going to end up in a tussle with Russia, China, the United States, or a combination of the above. And in that case, the Dutch will probably need to continue their current trend of quality, but maybe with slightly more and slightly larger ships. And I think that's actually a thing you see across an awful lot of the European navies. They're still riding a little bit. Well, two things. They're riding a little bit on inertia from the Cold War era, where they're thinking the people they're going to have to fight is Russia, so they don't want anything too big and obvious a target for a sunburn. And also, relatively speaking, Russia is relatively nearby, so they don't need anything particularly large because they don't have to go very far. And of course, the other aspect of it is, for politicians, a small warship costs less money, which makes it more attractive. But when you then take a lot of the European navies, if you were to say collectivize the EU countries in EU navies into a single navy, they would have an awful lot of ships.
But it wouldn't have an awful lot of commonality, though.
No, but the other thing is, an awful lot of their surface combat ships would be in what I call the fairly useless for global power projection category. Now, I mean,
I'm trying to think of which navy produces ones which actually would be good for global power projection capacity. I'm not even with the French, honestly, and certainly not the Germans.
I mean, the Horizon.
The Spanish?
The Horizons are kind of, they look a little bit like Type 45s, but not as good. Which, considering the design compromises that went into the Type 45.
largely because they were trying to produce the Horizon frigates.
Yeah.
And once they got to the point where they separated off, those design changes have been hard-baked in.
Yeah, but it's, I think you'd find with the European navies, you've got a lot of these 2 to 5,000 ton range ships. And again, they're good for coastal defense, and they're good for popping across one country over in the European theater to check on what's going on.
Yeah.
They're not really that useful beyond that.
Which is why I consider the Danish so interesting, because you consider Danish have a smaller navy in many ways than the Dutch.
Mm.
But then they have the Absalon class, and they have the Overhoofed class, which is, of course, the basis for Type 31.
Mm.
And you sit there and go, now, what is it that's made the Danish do this difference? And I think it does come down to sent to Greenland, i.e. they do have to hop across the Atlantic quite regularly. And they have to think about that. But I also think there is a factor which is beyond the European Union's potential changes and beyond all the other scenarios, which might also have a similar impact on the Dutch as it had on the Danish. And that is, the Dutch do have a lot of links to Southeast Asia. They do have a lot of links there. And they have a lot of commercial interests still in that area. And they might well decide, hang on, we need to start deploying something to that region, which actually looks significant. And as much as I love the Seven Provincial class, I'm not sure they have enough in the way of bite for that role. What do you think?
Well, again, it falls under the category of they're good for the European theatre, not necessarily quite good enough for the overall theatre. I mean, I'd put more faith in the Dutch ships than I would in a lot of European-built ships the moment on a global scale. But they're the kind of thing where they're doing a pinch on a global scale, but maybe not. Maybe if they are going to think about going properly global, they maybe need a sort of a Disevan Prevencian B, mod B type.
Oh, yes. Something slightly bigger. And slightly more capable. Preferably with... Well, you see, the thing is that the 7th Prevention class do fill the anti-ballistic missile role to an extent with their capabilities. But, again, that's a fear-to-defense system in many ways for the European theater. They need to be stronger if they're going to be a viable thing for sending out to the Far East. Because... Again, you can't imagine the Dutch deploying one ship. And this is something for listeners to think about. If you are able to deploy a ship and basically base it out there permanently, like I think Britain is probably going to end up doing with a Type 31 at Singapore, rather like it's got a Type 31 based in the Gulf, you are able to go for a level of capability because you can say this is our forward deployed ship, and the Type 26s and the aircraft carriers and Type 45s back there, they're our battle group, and they'll deploy out here on occasion and show that we can really have the muscle, but that's not our permanent presence ship. But unless, if you're not going to do that, if you're going to do a yearly visit sort of scenario to show that you're interested in the region, the ship you need to turn up with needs to be good. And I'm talking good to a level that, okay, not Arleigh Burke size, we're talking that, or not Sir John the Great, but good to a level of Type 45-ish scale. What do you think?
I'd broadly agree. I would say that... See, and again, tell me if you agree with... if you agree with this position, but I would generally look at things like the Disevan Prevencians, but also if you look at things like the Type 23s.
Mm-hmm.
So the Type 23 is what I would call the minimum viable threshold for something that's a truly ocean-going surface combatant.
Yeah.
And that's 5,000 tons, give or take. It's primarily anti-submarine warfare focused. So I would say that's kind of the lowest threshold of issues. The lowest threshold of things to look at when you're looking at what you're going to have for an ocean-going anti-submarine frigate. For an ocean-going anti-air warfare vessel, I think you probably need to add at least 2,000 to 3,000 tons onto that. So... I mean, the Type 45s have a bit more than that on them, which helps. But this is why I'm a little bit on the fence with the Disevan Prevencians, because once they're sort of soaking wet and at sea, they're just over 6,000 tons, which means they do hull wise, size wise, they meet the criteria. But they are designed to be kind of pocket air defense ships. Which a 6,000 tonner air defense vessel, yeah, you can do it, but this is why I say I'd be a little bit leery about it.
It's gonna have, if you're packing all the equipment you need to do the role, you aren't gonna have a lot of space for a lot of other things, including a lot of, how do I put this, a lot of ammunition, for starters. You're going to be dependent on the idea that you can quickly get in somewhere and restock, especially as I don't think that the 7th Prevention are designed to restock at sea.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, if you're going to build a 6,000 ton frigate, and that's going to be your major ocean capable thing, because that's kind of the biggest that you're prepared to go. Maybe you don't want to go for an 8,000 to 10,000 ton destroyer. I can understand that, but if you're going to do that, you need more of them. And I think this comes back to our previous discussions about how you manage your situation when you are a small navy. And we said it's probably better when you're a small navy to go for fewer larger vessels rather than a slightly greater number of small vessels, because a slightly greater number of small vessels will just immediately get smashed by a larger power who can afford more and bigger ships. Whereas if you go for a few somewhat bigger ships, then you're at least a one-on-one match or exceeding or overmatch for the general purpose kind of ship that you might run across. Something like the Seven Provincians would be they are good ships in and of themselves, but if I was going to be taking units of them overseas, I'd want to be taking them in batches of half a dozen to a dozen, and there's only four of them. FFGX outmasses them by sort of 10 to 20%, depending on exactly which figures you read, and the FFGX is going to be, let's face it, the lowest grade of hull that the US Navy is probably going to be happy taking into a frontline combat situation. Yes, in theory they could bring the LCS with them, but
in practice, the LCS is going to be the minesweeping duty. It's going to be those sort of missions.
There's less complicated and less expensive ways of saying we're bringing some expendable decoys. LCS in a frontline combat, we're escorting the carrier's role, basically. If it absorbs a few Zircons or Chinese equivalents, then that's probably better than those going through and hitting something that's actually worth something. But it wouldn't be a fun job to have.
No, it wouldn't be. And it's not really... The thing about having the LCS with you is they're keep up with you speed-wise, but by gull, will you have to refuel them quite often.
You might as well just tow them behind the Nimitz, like they used to tow boats in the 17th century.
Yeah, you see, that's something which I'd like as a New Year's resolution for navies to think about again. I want you to start. I want navies of the world to start thinking about having. Well, they're not going to be torpedo boats anymore, but didn't the battleships used to deploy these third class little torpedo boats, didn't they? I would love ships to get on to deploying these little sort of unmanned warships from their backs, these little attack ships. I just think that would cause nightmares for so many of the navies which are building up to try and cause trouble. Because if you consider about it, if you're talking about some of the stuff which is taking place in the Far East with the Chinese, etc., against the Allies, their main thing is that they're potentially able to cause damage to a very, very expensive vessel which has crew aboard, which your rules of engagement don't want to risk. But suddenly, if they're dealing with an unmanned vessel that you're less worried about getting bashed because you'll just build another one and doesn't have any crew on, and it's close enough to a big vessel that you want to get to the big vessel, but to get through it, you have to get past this unmanned thing, which might well ram into you first. That changes your entire approach, doesn't it?
Actually, before I forget, I'd also say other New Year's resolution for navies. I know Grey has become shorthand for warship the past few decades, but let's face it, it's boring. It doesn't really accomplish all that much because visual camouflage is not really a thing anymore.
It didn't even accomplish that much even when it was painted grey.
The most effective visual camouflage schemes in both world wars were when people put false funnels and such up. As a result of that, I'd say, can we just all agree that there is no point apart from cultural inertia to have these things around, these grey holes around anymore? Let's go back to the late 19th, early 20th century peacetime colour schemes.
Or if you're the US Navy and you want to avoid rust showing up in your ship, just paint them all red. They paint the entire thing red.
Yeah, but it's like, bring
you
back
call the, themselves the Santa Claus fleet.
But I think the old peacetime color schemes would work so much better. They'd they'd make them distinct. I mean, much as I enjoyed being at the 2005 Spithead Naval Review,
yes,
it was, apart from the
you and I couldn't have been very far away from each other at that time, Ben.
No. Apart from the amphibious assault ship that the Americans sent, which was very obvious by its size, everything else, without breaking out the binoculars, was a case of, I wonder which Navy that grey blob belongs to.
It's a grey blob.
Whereas if it was like, well, that one is white with gold trim, so that must be the US Navy. That one is black with white superstructure and buff upper work, so that's Royal Navy, and so on and so on and so on.
What were the Chinese to paint their ships?
I think they took a leaf off the Germans, if I'm not mistaken. When would be the problem is they didn't have that many ships around at the end, thanks to the many Sino-Japanese wars. I mean, looking at the Chenyuan, I think that it seems to have very, very, very dark hull colours. So I think it's probably following the German style, dark hulls, mm-hmm. light upper works, dark funnels scheme, which would, again, it wouldn't look too bad. And since, I mean, also since we're all supposed to be convinced that the Chinese are the bad guys, let's face it, if they paint their ships black, it will help with that.
Mm.
But then on the other hand, if you want to be in China and look at it from a positive side, you can say, well, actually, black ships, let's face it, they do look pretty cool.
That they do. All the ships on all my fleet on Galactic Civilizations. Mm-hmm. are black with blue trim.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, so they've got black hulls, black turrets, and a kind of yellowish masts and funnels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not bad at all. In a lot of ways, it's similar to the... It's basically if you take the British colour scheme, but you remove the white upper works aspect. And a slightly deeper yellow. Although the replica they've made has the white upwards. The replica they've made, weirdly enough, and I don't know why, the replica that the Chinese have made actually has the full Royal Navy black, white, and buff colour scheme, which is a bit bizarre considering all the photos of their ships immediately after the Yalu River quite clearly show that this was not, in fact, the case.
So, I think we've dealt with the important things, colour schemes, bringing back small deployable attack ships that have fun with anyone trying to ram you, and actually getting some procurement decently organised. Have we mentioned actually working out what a Type 32 is going to be?
We kind of mentioned it, but yeah.
Okay.
As I was saying to Jamie back in 2020, I'm personally not entirely sure that the idea is entirely sound to be running around with four different hull types on what is ultimately a relatively small surface force. So I would like there to be either a high degree of interoperability and interchangeability between the Type 32 and one of either the Type 31 or Type 26.
My theory is it will be the Type 31, as you know.
Yeah. So that would be my ideal. But I am kind of torn on that because, on the one hand, interoperability with the Type 31 would be very good for obvious reasons, and it would open up potential export market as for navies who are in the market for something that's not a all singing all dancing top end frigate. But on the other hand, it does mean the Royal Navy would have relatively few top-end frigates and some much smaller ships floating around. Whereas, yeah, in an ideal world, sort of a one step off the Type 26 would be great. But,
To be fair, the Type 31, if you consider the Ivar Hubfeld class, does have scope to be turned into a far more capable frigate.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the baseline for the Type 31 isn't a bad ship. I do like the Ivar Hubfelds quite a lot, and anything that builds on that is going to be quite good as well. Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a lot more. I think the thing is, I still have a lot of a big chip in my shoulder about the fact we're not going to have quite as many Type 26s as I would have preferred to see. But if we're not going to have them, then, well, we might as well just keep going and see what we can do with the smaller ships. But I think they do need to nail it down. Because the thing is, the sooner they nail it down with the Type 32s, the sooner they can place the orders. The sooner they can place the orders, the sooner they can decide on some cancel-proof names, and the sooner they can ensure they'll actually get built.
So, what do you think of cancel-proof names? What names do you think would be cancel-proof? Because my bet is that it would be some form of I don't think you can go for place names again, but I'm wondering if you can go for admirals. I'm wondering if you can go for some sort of historically significant personnel names.
You could do. When it comes to it, council-proof names. I would like to see a series of ships named after UK admirals, but at the same time, historically, most ships that have carried the names of UK admirals have been considerably larger, and the Type 32s, whatever they turn out to be, are going to be on the lower end of the Royal Navy spectrum. So, whilst it would be nice to see some admirals recognised, it kind of feels like a little bit of a slap in the face. If you're going to name ships after admirals, you should at least give them what these days either a destroyer or at least a high-end frigate, not a mid-tier frigate. Personally, and this was pointed out to me to a certain degree recently, personally, I have a weakness for looking at them and going, well, maybe we should name them after the tribal class destroyers or another famous Royal Navy destroyer class, because, okay, yes, they have still used destroyer names for the Type 45s, but ultimately the destroyer is the, now, outside of a very few circles, the destroyer is now the biggest and nastiest surface combatant that isn't something that carries aircraft. So in that respect, I would probably go for moving destroyer flotilla names down into the lower end frigate categories now, and then if they're still using cruiser names for what are now the big frigates, then the capital ship names, some of the less impactful capital ship names should probably go onto the destroyers. So, I mean, obviously you're going to keep stuff like Warspite for the really big ones, but some of the things like Benbow or Marlborough, that kind of stuff. I mean, I know Marlborough is a Type 23 now, but I'd probably put those on the destroyers, because if you're going to cities, counties, and sort of the second tier of battleship names should go on the destroyers. For the lower end frigates, yeah, the old destroyer names. And I think the tribal class could work. Obviously, there would be a certain amount of sensitivity surrounding them now, because back in the day, you could quite happily name ships like Nubian and Gurkha and Maori and Sikh without anyone raising an eyebrow. But you probably would have faced some kind of inevitable backlash if you just went on and did those things without any consultation these days. But on the other hand, it could be a good PR opportunity because, at least as far as the World War II tribal class were concerned, from what I've been able to tell, a number of the groups who had destroyers named after their group were actually quite taken with it. The Maori chieftains were quite taken with HMS New Zealand back in World War I. The Ashanti were apparently very taken with HMS Ashanti in the run-up to World War II. So they seem to approve of it. And I think if the Royal Navy, it would be a delicate balancing act and probably something that would have to be done in private first. But if they wanted a nice bit of good PR, if they were to name the Type 32s after some of the tribal class, but consulted privately with those various groups first to get their approval, I have a feeling ships like, names like HMS Sikh and HMS Maori might well actually find a positive reception with the people who are part of those ethnic groups, and thus the Royal Navy could then get approval to use them, which would be quite nice. Alternatively, obviously, there are the options of just taking one of the letters of the alphabet and going with that as a A, B, C, D, E class. Although, given that we've got the D class with the Darings, if they are going to stick with that at the higher end, maybe take a cutoff name, cutoff letter somewhere around maybe the M's, and go with the M's and so forth. Something like Matchless is a good one to have. What else could you have apart from under the M's? You've got Matchless. You could have even name them after not admirals, although I suppose he did make an admiral later on, Manly Power. That would be a hilarious name, HMS Manly Power. It works even if you shorten it one way or the other. But you could go on down the list through the various letters. I mean, because the astutes have grabbed the A names, and so you don't have to worry about the submarines jumping in and stealing your thunder on the further on letters of the alphabet. But yeah, I think that naming conventions definitely do need to have a little bit of a look at in the Royal Navy to make sure everything standardizes and scales well with historic ship names. The Americans have apparently seemed to have finally got their act together with it when it comes to coming up with good names for the frigates and the submarines. So yeah, we'll just have to see what happens when it comes to ship naming, I think. And this is where we insert a break.
It's where we should insert a break, because while Drac was happily carrying on there and being very, very nice, I ordered my food. I think Drac talked about ordering food, so I presumed he was ordering it.
Mm.
But he actually didn't. Or he did, and it's still coming.
It's on its way.
And mine arrived. So I was quickly head popped down to do it, which is another reason why Drac was probably talking so much about tribal class destroyers to wind me up, because I could hear it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't say anything. I do agree about the consultation thing.
Mm.
I think Nubian might work quite well, because I don't think they exist anymore.
But you'd be hard-pressed to really argue they existed in World War II. I think they were still around to a certain degree, but let's face it, most of the historical references to Nubia and Nubians mostly involve ancient Egypt.
Yes, and I have a feeling there's also this always the joyous thing that is the Tartars and Cossacks.
Mm.
Who, again, let's be honest, either of them were going to object, probably not.
Yeah. Although, yeah, I suppose, yeah, getting those approvals might be a little bit more difficult. But you could still go for it. Still at least try.
Do you need to get approvals for Tartar and Cossacks?
Depends. I mean, most of them, Crimea. It would be touching a little bit of a live wire with someone or other, I suspect.
Yeah. I don't know. It could be fun. We do need to start sorting these things out. We do need to start getting some proper names coming in, because ship naming is something which matters. And the reason it matters is because that name sets a tone for the crew. Again, as much as I love Admiral Manly Powers, I have a feeling his first name at least could run into trouble.
Just call it HMS Power.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, because if they do go down that route, I mean, if they go down the Admiral's names, they're not going to call it the HMS John Jellicoe. It'll be HMS Jellicoe.
We'd hope.
So HMS Power would make sense. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I'd prefer to reserve names like Cunningham or Jellicoe for, as I was saying, for some of the bigger ships. But things at the same, I don't want to suggest that their contributions to the Royal Navy were lesser, because they weren't, but someone like Jellicoe who fought at Jutland, or someone like Cunningham who held the Mediterranean together.
They're a fairly high status unit.
Yeah. Whereas whilst someone like Admiral Vian gave excellent service to the Royal Navy, he's not perhaps as well known as someone like Cunningham or Jellicoe. So perhaps a kind of, yeah, if you wanted to do an admiral class, maybe use those kind of admirals. The admirals who deserve a ship named after them haven't had a ship named after them, but probably wouldn't win a fight on the Royal Navy's naming board to get a destroyer or larger named after them.
Oh, yeah. There's always the other option. They decide to go for the castle class again.
Yeah. We've got so many castles.
They do like place names.
But I think this is the thing. It's like, if you name them after some of the slightly lesser known admirals, again, you say it sets a tone for the ship and a tone for the crew. If you name them after a big pile of falling down masonry, that doesn't really inspire much confidence.
And if you call them HMS Windsor and HMS Edinburgh Castle, you've got a problem, because you've got HMS Edinburgh as well. This is one of the town class.
Yeah. And if you name them after, like, I don't know, Eltham Castle or Banborough Castle, you're going to constantly have people who think they're clever showing up with their English heritage season passes.
Or Bodiam.
Mm.
Oh, that'd be fun.
That would be quite funny to try and see someone argue their way aboard a Royal Navy castle class ship just because they have a National Trust or English Heritage ticket.
It would be quite interesting.
Yeah, I think I'm coming down more on the lines of either consult with people for the tribal class or the lesser known admirals. Because, I mean, let's face it, someone like Vian started off as a destroyer officer anyway.
I have another name suggestion for you.
Go on.
Battle class.
There's certainly enough of them.
I think they'd be quite a good one.
Mm.
And you could probably get away with that without the consultations you need for the tribals.
Yes.
And it would be less difficult than, let's say, the admirals, because it's deciding who is a lesser known admiral but is still deserving of a ship.
At that point the only thing you'd probably be looking at, given the what's going to be the likely run size, would be which era of battles shall we go for. I mean, if you really wanted to poke some sensitivities, you could call one San Carlos.
That could be fun. I think you'd probably go for Trafalgar.
Yeah. Trafalgar, St. Vincent, Niall, Camperdown,
Toronto, Mattapan.
Well, that's World War II, isn't it? I'm trying to either sort of go Age of Sail, World War I, or World War II.
I'm just trying to go for high-profile battles.
And that's true.
That were definitely victories, unlike Jutland, which is a sort of, well, I still consider it a British victory because because the Germans don't come out to sea again, but you know. That's me with my, what were you fighting for this battle for? Was it to control the North Sea? If it was, you achieved it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, Mattapan would be good. Toronto would be good. I think I'd actually, but although, yeah, I say, to be honest, I'd prefer to have a single period stick around the Age of Sail, because there's a lot of good ones that you can pull from there, including some which will be, they'll probably have ships named after them. I mean, I know Mattapan had a battle class named after it, so there's that. But if you go, the further back you go, the more likely it is that the Royal Navy's already named a ship after it, which again gives the ship some history.
Which is can have a battle crew.
On, yeah, have a battle honours plate up there for them. Or go back for Greek myths.
Mm.
Agamemnon, Arethusa Mars.
Class.
Mm. Agamemnon, Mars, Bellerophon.
I am conscious we have got quite a long way from New Year's resolutions for navies. Mm. But there again, we don't have Jamie because we managed to turn him into a rage ball that could power the sun many times over.
Okay, so, well, we have also just about hit our hour. So let's see, what can we wrap up with the New Year's resolution? We've kind of addressed most of the big navies. We can't really address the Chinese Navy's New Year resolution too much.
Is that because we don't want to give them hints, or because we can't really think about anything they could improve? Because
I like Chinese food, so I'd rather not whatever the Chinese version of the KGB is to try and slip heavy metal into my next Uber Eats order.
And haven't we already done enough to deserve that, probably already?
I think we've done enough to deserve it if they could figure out which one is our nearest Chinese restaurant. But fortunately, there's a lot of them in this area.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to wipe out the entire population of Surrey.
I absolutely recommend... I'm trying to think which of the Chinese restaurants in the area I don't actually go to. No, I go round them all occasionally.
Mm. Yeah. We've covered the Russians. Oh, yeah. Here's one to close out: the Indian Navy.
Mm?
We haven't covered them.
We did.
Did
Corbett Mahan. They need to learn what they're going to do.
Yeah, fair enough.
But if you've got another for them, carry on.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, please, after so many years, get your home-built aircraft carrier into service.
Oh yes.
I mean, you did an as I've said before, they did an excellent job converting that old Kiev class. It actually not only looks like a proper carrier now, but it actually looks very aesthetically pleasing.
It actually works.
Yeah. It'd be nice to see them getting their home-built carrier up and running. I mean, it'll have taken the better part of a decade, but... Yeah, please get that up and running so that we can have something to look at that isn't either Western nations or China when it comes to carrier design.
We do want that because it would be interesting. The Indian Navy's approach, as I said, they've got to, if they're going to, the other thing they've got to do is start having some auxiliaries.
Mm. Yeah, but this is the thing. You learn and develop the most when you're confronted with things that are a little bit out of context. And whilst seeing lots and lots of ships all armed with the same weapon systems, usually standard missiles, all looking like they're all slightly wonky derivatives of the same grey box mould is all very well and good. It does kind of get you into a little bit of a rut design-wise, and it's good for everyone to see what someone else comes up with. Because
it's also a nice idea to for the another reason for to have the repainting and the paint schemes, just make it different.
Yeah, because I mean, if you look at things historically, whilst there were some developments in the early part of the 19th century when you had the Seppings and Simmons revisions to how you designed wooden warships, unless you're an expert in the field, if you stuck a bunch of pictures of frigates and ships of the line from, say, the 1840s in front of someone and said, right, which nation is which, if you took away the flags, they'd be very hard
pressed. And some of the paint schemes.
Well, yeah, all the black and white photos. But it would be very hard to tell just from looking at them who's who. But then you have Gloire, then you have Warrior, and the differences between those two and some of the other ironclad concepts that people came up with led to a massive explosion of both ideas and technological development. And the same thing again when you look at battleships, when you get up to the Dreadnought era, the lines of development for the major navies that were all building battleships all are actually very different, to the point that you can tell at a glance, without too much education, what nation the ship likely belonged to, or at the very least which nations the ship doesn't belong to. And there was a whole confluence of ideas there, because you had Dreadnought bringing in turbine propulsion, all big guns and everything, but it was the Americans who brought in the super firing turret, the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians who brought in the triple turret. The French obviously eventually came up with quad. The Americans came up with all or nothing armor. The Germans had a much heavier bias towards armor than firepower. The British brought most of the World War One period brought in the heaviest guns. And then later on you had radar, you had sonar, inclined armor. All these things came from all over the place, and different people's innovations forced everybody collectively to catch up, adapt, overcome, and advance. Mm. And so, with the best will in the world,
decide whether your own advantages mitigated those advantages, yeah, so you didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and with the best will in the world, the Russians can design some very interesting things, but they are kind of running out of steam a little bit at the moment.
They're not building them.
Yeah, they're just not building things. The Chinese are building things, but are obviously, well, A, they're being very cagey about some of their systems capabilities, and B, as I have said several times in the past, I am rather worried about the fact you're seeing a quasi-racist attitude from a lot of people in the West, which has worrying echoes of especially the American and to a certain extent the British attitudes to the Japanese in the run-up to World War II, of, oh, look, the strange Oriental people, they can't do anything but copy us and in an inferior manner. So at no point has anybody who's ever made that assumption ever come out of it looking good, usually because the people they thought were copying them turned around and smacked them very hard with stuff that wasn't copies.
Yes, well, this is the trouble.
And
it's half the trouble when you're dealing with the topic of China and you're talking to people about it, they go, is it really a threat? Because all they do is copy us.
Well, and I think between the fact the Chinese are cagey about their capabilities and this cultural problem that I think a lot of people in the West seem to have, there's not going to be a tremendous amount learned in the Western navies until somebody starts shooting at someone, at which point the learning curve is going to be very, very fast and very, very steep. And so I think we kind of need these third parties to innovate and build things differently to how we do things. The French, to a certain degree, offer that, but they kind of do their own thing all the time, but they are still semi-integrated into everything else. But something with...
And plus, they are the French, and the biggest statistic you hear about their aircraft carriers is how many loaves of bread it produces a day.
Mm. But someone like the Indians, they have the economic capability on paper to produce some rather interesting and quite numerous military classes of vessel. whether or not the industry and the political structure, etc., is up to it, in terms of producing first-rate frontline combatants, time will tell. Stuff like the INSAS and the Tejas and the Arjun don't exactly fill with massive amounts of confidence, but then on the other hand, they do also have the Brahmos, so, and the their converted Kiev, so swings and roundabouts on that. But I would be very interested in seeing what kind of things they come up with in the future.
The Tarawals weren't too bad, aren't too bad, are they? They're just no. They're frigates.
No. I quite like those. When they're not setting them on fire.
Well,
I suppose I think the accidentally setting fire to your ship in a port thing has probably become somewhat less of a black mark on any individual navy after the Bonhomme Richard, because if it can happen to them, if it can happen to Bonhomme Richard, it can happen to pretty much anybody.
And that is a problem.
Mm.
Perhaps that's another New Year's resolution. Better firefighting in ports.
Or just don't set fire to your ships in the first place.
We always hope for that.
Mm-hmm.
We'd hope that goes without being set out, without saying.
Yeah. But there you go. So, yeah, final New Year's resolution. Come on, India, show us something interesting.
Yeah.
That doesn't take a decade to build.
Yeah. Something that allows us to get our teeth into it and goes, that's giving me ideas.
Yeah. All right, well, on that note...
thank you very much, everyone.
And that's our first episode of 2021.
Good Lord, I'm being organised because we're recording this in 2020.
And just for safety's sake, just in case, do avoid the death bots, everybody. If you can set the zombie hordes against the death bots with occasional assistance from the locust horde, that's usually a good way of evading them.
Yeah.
Castle Drac is reinforcing defences as we speak. Flamethrowers are installed. Long-range anti-aircraft batteries are in the works. Haven't quite settled on a self-destruct system, but we shall see.
I was thinking a self-destruct system is a bit of a self-defeatist attitude.
Well, it depends. Self-destruct systems can also work as orbital lance weapons if you build them big enough.
Mm, okay.
Put a giant steel plate in the bottom of the house, launch yourself into the sky, Iron Drive style.
And the other thing we will add is we will be starting back in January with the recording. We will be starting back, hopefully, with, as said, some special guests, as in listeners who've written in. But, you know, we might also take a week off because we are... Jamie has got his children home for 6 weeks because it's their summer holiday in Australia. And me and Track are both planning on enjoying Christmas to New Year. Which is one reason why we've recorded these all early. So, there might be about a 1 week gap without an episode in January. We hope you won't mind. We hope you'll go back and listen again to the Christmas special, which will be 2 hours long. And thank you. Take care and talk to you soon.
See you later.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.